morning, everyone. The Mary Griffith Show is underway. Talk Radio 930 WTAD, brought to you by Hilbeen Auto Body. If it happens to you, take it to Hilbeen. And today, probably for the last time, in his capacity as fire chief of Quincy, Illinois, is Joe Henning. Joe has announced his retirement, and by the time the next Quincy Firefighter Mary Griffith Show comes on, somebody else will be somebody else's problem, right?
Let's hope so.
Congratulations, Joe, on your retirement and on your Joe Bonansinga Award. Why don't you give us a brief excerpt from your acceptance speech? Because I know that was quite a surprise to you to be honored with the Joe Bonansinga Award from the Rotary Club and the United Way.
It was absolutely a surprise, and unfortunately I wasn't actually able to be there in person because I was in training in Bloomington, but it was a humbling experience. You know, I've been involved in a lot of organizations, and a lot of times they see fit to recognize you, but this one was certainly special because it was kind of looking at the breadth of, I guess, one's entire involvement in the community and career. And, you know, you don't really think about it because you're just out there doing what you love and what you have a passion for. And then somebody comes along and gives you an attaboy. It's certainly appreciated. So.
Well, the thing about it is it's almost a lifetime achievement award. How old are you, Joe?
I'm 50.
Yeah,
so.
Well.
I guess I could pack it in now.
I think what I always say, because I've gotten 3 Lifetime Achievement Awards, I always say, well, I'm just going to try to live up to it, because definitely I hope to be doing even more. And while we've got you here, just because this will be the last time we get to talk to you, you have been teaching at Western Illinois University, so this really isn't anything new, but you're leaving the fire department and you're pretty much going into teaching. Is that going to be a full-time occupation for you now?
It is. I'm not only going to be an instructor, but I'm also going to be basically taking the reins of the fire science program. We're going to be centered under the law enforcement program, but we have about 88 kids in the program right now, and my task is to recruit and develop and increase that membership in that program and get kids more involved. So, classes will be one thing on my agenda, but there'll be a lot more as well. So I'll get to travel the state, go to high schools, do some recruiting, talk about firefighting, which is something I've done for about 28 years now. So that'll work out well.
So you'll basically be doing what you're doing. You'll just be teaching the next crop of youngins coming up about fire science. Well, that is great. And I know the training you took in Bloomington is also, again, that wasn't paid for by the city of Quincy, because I was teasing your wife. I said, what? He's retiring in a month, and our tax dollars are sending him on
this. I did it all myself. Took vacation time. Yes, I did it all on my own. So
he did all, but it is also going to help you, because one of the things it's going to help you be able to do is render assistance then to fire departments who will look to Western Illinois University and will look to you in your capacity as a professor there to say, what do we need in a fire chief?
Yeah, so in the state of Illinois, there's a law that dictates how firefighter promotions take place. And one of the components of a promotion process is an assessment center. And there are laws that dictate how that works, but you have to be certified as an assessor in the state of Illinois to be able to function at that level. They offer this training about once every 3 or 4 years, so it doesn't come around very often. That's why I couldn't get back to town. I've had a board position with the Illinois Fire Chiefs Association and had some conversations with them, and there's some need for some new assessors. You know, a lot of people do this in retirement or as a second career, and they get to the point where they just don't want to do it anymore. So I'm going to throw my hat into the ring, make myself available. It's going to be limited, obviously, because I'll be teaching, but it's something I could do in the summer times and on weekends maybe to help out.
Okay, now the ugly question, and as long as you're still on the public payroll, well, you'll still be on the public payroll at WIU, but I won't be asking you ugly questions. You're retiring at 50. Do you get your full pension?
I do get a pension, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You know, this is part of the reason. I'm not denying that you signed on, you mm-hmm. need it, you know, you deserve it because you worked for it, but is this not moving forward one of the problems we're going to have with police officers, firefighters, even teachers to a certain degree, anybody on a government pension? Here you sit, a young, healthy man. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could work, you know, as a college professor another mm-hmm. 20, even 30 years, you
sure.
know?
Sure.
So you've completed your obligation to the city of Quincy and to the taxpayers mm-hmm. of the city of Quincy, and now our obligation begins to you to give you a check, continue to give you a check
right.
every month as part
right.
of your retirement. Taking a step back and taking yourself out of the equation, just running a business, is this any way to run a business, or is this sustainable at all?
You know, there's a couple of different facets to that question, in my opinion, at least. As a fire administrator and having been the chief for 12 years, I can tell you that when you're dealing with firefighters, the older they get, The longer it takes for them to recover from a firefighting situation, if they get injured, the longer it takes for them to come back. In a lot of cases, it's kind of a case of diminishing returns. The older they are, if they get hurt, the less the likelihood is they're going to come back. And when you get to that situation, if they are injured, then they go off on a disability pension, would cost even more money than what a regular pension would. So it's kind of double-edged sword. Yes, absolutely. I'm going to keep working. We know that. I'm going to WIU. So it's just me choosing to work somewhere else.
But you're not going to have to scale a tall building.
No, I won't. No. So should there be an administrative portion versus a firefighter portion? I certainly something to talk about. I will tell you there is a second tier of firefighters in the pension fund, and their retirement age has been pushed to 55 rather than 50.
So there is some progress.
So there is progress. So people that came on, and forgive me, I don't know the exact date, probably 12, 13 years ago, that passed, and anybody hired after that date cannot retire until 55, and they have to have more time in before they can retire. So there has been some tiering taking place.
But do you think that there needs to be even more be done? Because, again, once you sign on to a job, I totally respect the fact that you worked and you were promised this pension and
right.
you deserve this pension. It was
right.
what was promised you.
Right.
But I'm talking about people hired 2 years from now. Couldn't there be something done to say, look, and like you said, if they stay in an administrative role, maybe they can work longer.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're a line fireman, you know, they're going to have to retire at a certain age, or they can retire at a certain age, but they won't get their full pension unless they stay on the force or something like that, because it's becoming untenable. You could literally live another 50 years.
Absolutely.
Your wife could.
I doubt it, but.
but it could happen.
Sure.
Your wife could live,
right.
you know, another 40 years. And so this pension is going to be paid out longer than you actually worked for the Quincy Fire Department.
That could be.
Very Absolutely. Possible.
Absolutely.
So basically, whenever we hire a firefighter at this point in time, we're looking at not only the salary that we're paying them while they're working, but we're basically hiring two people. One person to work, and the other shadow person that we have to pay
right.
in retirement.
Right. So the way the pension works, like the one I'm under, it's like you got to have at least 20 years on the job, and when you do, you get 50% of your salary, and then each additional year you work, there's an additional percentage added. On the tier two, same thing, push back to 55, a little bit. The accrual rate is lower, so they've done some things to address that. You know. I'm going to be honest with you, probably one of the biggest things that hurt the pension fund, in my opinion, and I understand why we did it, but it used to be a widow's pension was basically half of what the firefighter got, and it never increased. So once that firefighter passed, the widow got that pension, and we literally had people, you know, widows on the pension fund whose husbands had died 20 and 30 years ago that were bringing in a minuscule amount of money, you know what I mean? And one thing people don't realize with firefighters, we don't pay into Social Security, so we don't draw Social Security. And a lot of people think, oh my gosh, they get a pension, they get Social Security, yada, yada, yada. That's not the case. So that does impact that a little bit too. Now, hopefully, all the firefighters are doing just what everybody else should be doing, putting some money away and saving for a rainy day and doing all that. But you're absolutely right. There are issues that need to be addressed. There's been a lot of good conversations. Mayor Trope has taken that on as one of the things he wants to tackle and figure out how to fund that. It's a tall order. There's no doubt about that. And the biggest challenge is all this is dictated from the state on high, and that's where we run into challenges.
Yeah, that's where, you know, Mike yep. Trope can talk all he wants, but unfortunately
yes.
the state right now. And, of course, you in your new job, which is your old, you know, you've been doing this for a while, very part-time teaching, but now in your full-time teaching job, you are going to be trying to get the best and the brightest to become firefighters. So, of course, you want the best wages and salaries for them. So the intrigue of it is interesting.
Absolutely.
You know, most of us, again, in the private sector would say, if I could retire at 50, because, you know, I mean, I at 50, I had a lot of years in, you
right,
know, but,
right, right.
but, you know, but I'm well past that. And guess what? The day I stop working here, nothing happens.
Right,
there's no pension.
Right.
There's no nothing. That's the way of the world.
Right.
Well, let's talk about another thing that came up. I saw this recently. State of Illinois was talking about this. The readiness for fire departments, kind of like a post 9/11 thing, which, you know, is now 20 years ago. Some people, you know, weren't even born that
mm-hmm.
remember the day, to have no memory of it really as an adult. But the readiness of fire departments, what does the Quincy Fire Department do on a day-to-day basis? I know you train proficiently to fight fires, to rescue people from vehicles, to do the airplane rescues if
mm-hmm.
you would have to. you know, in the back of our mind, you know, the terrorist attack is not something that's on our mind like it was 20 years ago.
Right.
But the fire department is still the first responder. So what kind of precautions, what kind of plans are in effect to happen if somebody, you get the call that we're under some kind of attack?
Sure. So the Quincy Fire Department actually houses a regional technical rescue team and a regional hazardous materials team. So the state of Illinois, and more specifically the Illinois Terrorism Task Force, which I, as the chief of the Quincy Fire Department, have a seat on that board. So I'm a part of that statewide association, and we help allocate monies to not only fire departments, but law enforcement. And it's basically looking at readiness across the state from every discipline. I mean, we have a chaplains group that's part of that association, the Red Cross, all ministerial associations, everything like that. So, specifically with Quincy, with our technical rescue and hazmat teams, we have received a cache of equipment. It's probably getting on 15 years now. So some of the stuff's starting to age out. And one of the challenges I've had as fire chief in the last 6 months is, I'll just use one example, breathing apparatus for hazardous materials response. The bottles we use for that have more capacity so we can stay in longer, because it's not go in, put out the fire, and leave. It's plug and dike and rescue, and it could be an hours-long process. So we have bigger capacity. Well, those air bottles are only good for 15 years. Those bottles have expired now. It's not as simple as just grabbing one of the ones we use on firefighting, because they're not the same thing. So We've been going for the last couple of years to the Terrorism Task Force and saying, look, we need to replenish this. And the response is, we don't have the money for it. You got to figure it out. As a regional team, you've taken the equipment and you've agreed to take the burden. And I agree with that. But at the same token, there is some money there, and we're all kind of clawing at it, trying to figure out what little piece we can get. But to that point, our teams do train on a regular basis, both on the technical rescue side, which includes disciplines such as confined space rescue, building collapse rescue, high angle rescue, vehicle and machinery technician rescue, and then the hazmat team as well. So pretty much anything that would happen, weapons of mass destruction, terrorist type event, the aftermath is going to fall within the realm of either hazmat or TRT. And Quincy is prepared for that. We're equipped for that. Now, granted, we're a smaller department in the grand scheme of things. We're supposed to be enabled to basically go in and initiate response with the understanding help will be about no more than 24 hours away so they can come in. And we have to do the same for another municipality. So if they call us, we go. When we show up, we have to be self-sufficient completely for 72 hours. Food, water, lodging, all that stuff. So we prepare for that. Our team has that equipment. And we know the day may come where we may get deployed for something like that.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, recently we've seen some different kinds of attacks, and those have been attacks from our own citizens burning down metro centers. We're going to talk about two things. I want to do these two things before you go, because I'm just being mean as heck to you today. It's his last trip here. Let's talk first about, you know, what happened, we'll call it the George Floyd effect. There were some towns where there were broken windows, mm-hmm. buildings burning, firefighters really, you know, not reluctant to go down there, but like, oh my God, you know, people are shooting back at us. I mean, we're supposed to be the fire department. People aren't supposed to be shooting at us.
Right.
We're supposed to be the guys they want to come. But of course, if you don't want the building to be put out, if you want the fire to burn, you don't want the fire department down there.
Right.
When things like that happen in the news, do you send out a memo? The chances of this happening in Quincy, Illinois are extremely remote, but let's all be aware and let's go and get our manual out. And what would happen if downtown Quincy was simultaneously ignited by some terrorist band?
So conversations have begun under that. Actually, Deputy Chief DeMondade, who's now with Urbana Fire Department, when he came on, he and I had a conversation. This is kind of in the midst of when all this started. And we had a conversation about how prepared would we be to deal with that type of stuff. So out of that sprung a conversation with Mayor Moore at the time to say, hey, as a city, we need to start looking at an initiative that's going to detail how every one of our departments is going to work together and respond. So DeMond worked on that, and then DeMond took another job. We have his brother Mike in there now. So Mike is actually the one that's going to be taking that process and moving it forward. We have a draft put together. Essentially what it boils down to is, one, excuse me, making sure police and fire and city administration are communicating. Two, it's looking at a situation where do we commit resources? Is it safe to do so? Because at the end of the day, we're not going to go in there and just trade lives to save property. That makes no sense in anybody's world. Are we willing to take risks to save lives? Absolutely. But it still has to be something where it's a calculated move. Is it a safe move? anything that we're going to do in that realm is going to directly involve the police department and working hand in hand with them to make sure it's a safe environment to put firefighters into. I was just talking to the ambulance chief, John Simon, a little while back. They purchased bulletproof vests for their personnel. We're not there yet. You know, it's one of those deals, you know, yeah, we have a policy. If X happens, we're going to put a vest on. Well, you know as well as I do, it's the element of surprise that gets everybody. So unless you're wearing it all the time, you know, from my perspective, I don't see that we're at the point where we need to put bulletproof vests on all firefighters. You know
my cousin,
I mean?
Tim McCarthy, is the Secret Service agent that took the bullet for Reagan. And he's a Secret Service agent. He didn't have his vest on.
Yeah, well,
you know,
there
after
you go.
That heavy thing, you're like, you got to be kidding me. What was the last
it's
time?
It's not something pleasant
yeah,
to wear.
What was the last
absolutely.
Time anybody, you know, I'm just not going to wear that today or any day. And the results, obviously, mm-hmm. thank God he lived. But
absolutely.
So you do have a plan. You've at least talked about it. And, of mm-hmm. course, it's a very scary and frightening thing because you used to think about when the JCPenney building burned, you know what, 30 years ago or whatever, that was a big response because the embers flying everywhere. Think if they, if instead of one building catches on fire, all of the multi-story buildings in Quincy mm-hmm. were torched. It would be quite dramatic. The other thing that you've come out of is COVID-19. And the fire department was very well prepared. I want to congratulate you on really giving some thought to what are we going to do if our firefighting force takes ill. And fortunately, you had a few illnesses, but it never happened to where you were really severely impacted. So talk a little bit about, because it was March 16th that the state of Illinois shut down, and we just now have reopened today. So maybe in a four-minute recap, how did you do COVID and how did you come out of COVID?
Well, you know, we had our first major challenge, and I was actually thinking of it this morning because it happened right before Father's Day weekend, and I was thinking about my plans with my family. Our entire administrative staff at the fire department got put into quarantine right before Father's Day last year because of a COVID exposure. So, you know, fortunately, I was one of the few that didn't actually come down with COVID, but I got stuck quarantined for 2 weeks.
The fire command was your basement.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a laptop there, and that was command central. But, you know, it certainly worked out. At that time, I think we had a total of, it was either 10 or 12 people that were quarantined. And for a 60-man department, that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, but we were able to weather storm because we'd already looked at contingency plans, how we were going to handle stuff, everywhere from if a firefighter had to quarantine and didn't feel safe doing it in their home, we had an alternative. We had worked out an agreement with QU to put people there. We had talked about if we got to the point where we couldn't staff under a normal staffing model, what a new model would look like, 24 on, 24 off, mandated hire backs, whatever the case may be. So we had really thought through that. We had looked at sanitation and everything else. The biggest challenge for us was personal protective equipment. We had a cache, but we didn't have what we were going to need to sustain a year's worth of response. So that was the biggest challenge, but we were able to work with emergency management in the state to get more stuff in. We even for a period of time, we quit responding on EMS calls because there was only so much equipment. And rather than expose both the ambulance and fire crews to a potential situation, the decision was made, let the ambulance handle it. Unless we knew it was a cardiac arrest, somebody was in dire need, then we would respond. But a lot of life-threatening situations can be handled by just the ambulance, but it's good to have us there because we can initiate care. But we had to back off for a little bit. But with all of those things, that allowed us to basically get through this situation relatively unscathed. I mean, no sustainable permanent damage that I'm aware of with any of the firefighters. You know, if I had to put a number on it, and I didn't come with those, but I would say probably over the course of the entire thing, we probably had about 25 people that quarantined at one point or another, so almost half of our department. But fortunately, it didn't just all hit us at once.
Okay. As you leave, Joe Henning, your replacement has not been named?
No.
Okay. Will you be able to work with this new fire chief?
The timeline is the last component of the testing and interviewing is taking place on July 8th. So by the time the Police and Fire Commission do that, get together, make a decision, they'll probably name my successor the week I retire. I will not likely get to work with them unless, I mean, there's both internal and external candidates, so it's possible it's somebody I already know. They may be able to step in, but if it's somebody from outside, that may not happen.
And there are two internal and three external?
I'm not allowed to know. I'm not allowed to say.
So. And you're not involved in the decision.
I am not.
Is that weird?
No, not at all. The idea behind having a police and fire commission is to take politics and influences out of it and hopefully have an independent body make a decision.
Okay. Any closing remarks on the last time he's thinking, I'm glad I don't have to do this anymore.
it's been a good run. I'm certainly going to be around. I'm not leaving Quincy. Obviously, right. Danielle and I have our roots here. And, you know, I'm looking forward to the challenges the WIU program will afford me. What's great about it is in my time here and working with WIU, we'd be able to forge a relationship between the two. And I'll be in Quincy a lot because we send our students here for live fire training. So
this could be the best thing to happen to the Quincy Fire
Department.
It's going
to work out well
like
for
the
us.
Feeder. Yeah. You're going to be like the best
be
and the
thing.
Brightest will be funneled into a recommendation.
It's going to be a good
that
thing.
They come and work.
Yeah,
well, good luck dealing with teenagers.
Yeah. Well,
You know, I mean, you've raised two and you've got another one. Well, you've got two college age kids that you've raised. They're up and out on their own and you've got one young one still, but it's a lot different, as you know, being a teacher. Sometimes they're not as, I think with fire safety, they're a lot more motivated to be in that class.
You know, you would think, but I've had some challenges already. So my biggest challenge is they got to understand that what you think works in college doesn't work in the real world, especially at a fire department. We're a paramilitary organization. You're on time. You do what you're told to do. That's a challenge for some. So.
And I used to always love it when we had assignments in journalism where we would be given a story and we had a week to work on it. I said, what real-world journalist has a week to do a story?
Right, exactly.
We'll tell you what happened at the Quincy City Council a week from today when I figure it out. So you're going to have a slower-paced life. Thank God we built a brand-new highway to go up to Macomb.
I'll be putting
Macomb.
A lot of miles in.
You'll be putting a lot of miles on your brand-new truck.
Yeah.
Okay. Joe, it's been a pleasure to work with you in a professional capacity, to get to know you a little bit better since you married one of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
Good move on your part, by
Absolutely.
The way. And it's been delightful to get to meet your children, and you've been a great asset, a Joe Bonansinga Award winner. No accolade I could put to you could be higher than that. So
I think they got it right,
and our loss is Western Illinois University's game, but thank God you're still in our ballpark, okay?
We'll be here, and it's going to be a good thing. So,
okay, thank you very much.
Coming up,
we're going to talk about the garden tour for Quincy Preserves. Well, it's not Saturday in the park. It's Saturday in 10 of your neighbor's backyard. Yeah, if you're nosy like me, boy, is tomorrow the prime event of the year for you. It's the Behind Garden Gates Tour put on by Quincy Preserves. And joining me today, I believe, is the president of Quincy Preserves, Eric Luce. Welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
And also, Stephanie Kachowski is here. Stephanie, what role do you play in the group?
I just do a lot of organizing and a little bit of marketing, too.
Okay. So I'm glad to have you both here. The event is tomorrow. I've already purchased my tickets because I'm a cheapskate, and I wanted to save money. It's tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. It is rain or shine event. And there are 10 backyards. Some of them are public, but there are 10 backyards, many of them private homes, that people have put up on the tour. So, Eric Luce, how hard is it to get people to volunteer? It's probably easier than getting them to volunteer to walk through their home on the Fall Preserves tour, but I can imagine that a lot of people are like, oh, no, what if my begonias are wilted on that day? What will people think of me?
Yes, it does take a little bit of coaxing and a little bit of begging and pleading, but our houses this year and our owners were very forthcoming and willing to open up their backyards and gardens and do all the prep work necessary to make it look beautiful for this weekend.
So this is totally a volunteer thing for them. They're just doing this to help Quincy Preserves.
Correct. They're really helping us as part of one of two of our main fundraising events, this one being the garden tour and then also, as you alluded to, our fall tour.
You're supposed to be on that microphone over there. No wonder you were sounding hollow. I'm sorry. You may sit where you want to sit, but you're on the – thank you. So it's all volunteer. People volunteer their homes. Now let's talk a little bit about – you've grouped them together. So that's the other thing. I guess neighbors kind of coerce other neighbors to help out because you've got them at 1501, 1503, 1505, and 1515 Kentucky, and then 1875 Kentucky. So right there in that neighborhood, that's another important aspect of the tour, isn't it, that people be able to kind of walk around and see it easily?
Yeah, we got really lucky this year, and that was a little bit of peer pressure, I think, from neighbors. we'll have a row of houses there along Kentucky that'll be a great experience, sort of a cluster of different backyards to experience.
And really, in a way, since those backyards all adjoin to a certain degree, one person's garden is almost the next person's garden, because I always say I not just enjoy my landscaping, but my neighbor's landscaping as well. So that's what it's all about. So the cost of the tickets, if they buy them tomorrow on the day of the tour, is $18, and they can get them at the Women's City Club. Is that the only place to get them?
At the day of the tour, correct. Up until this evening, they can purchase them at Curlin's as well as Emerald City Jewelers and as well as online from QuincyPreserves.org.
Yeah, I stopped by Emerald City Jewelers because I wanted to see the new jewelry store, too. And that's where I got my tickets. So they're only $15 if you buy them in today. Walk into Emerald City Jewelers, walk into Curlin's at the Quincy Town Center, or you can get them online at QuincyPreserves.org. Now, let's talk a little bit about these 10 homes. Who knows a little bit about these gardens and what we're going to see? Is that you, Stephanie?
I know a little bit about the gardens. I know that there's one that has an amazing hosta collection that there are how many varieties? It was over 100, I believe.
There's over 1,000 hosta varieties, so these people have really gone all in.
Gone all in. And then there's the house on 18th Street, beautiful, and they have transplanted so many different varieties of plants into their yard. Phenomenal, beautiful. And then some also new historical discoveries in their backyard, which was pretty interesting to find out about as well.
So while they were digging around, they dug up a dinosaur or something?
They dug up, they dug up something in their backyard, which you get to learn about
on
the tour.
Which we get to learn about.
Yeah.
Because it's not just walking through these beautiful spaces, but there'll be a docent there. There'll be a guide there. And if you say, well, now what is that? Hopefully they'll kind of know what it is.
Yes, the guide will be there. And a lot of the homes, the homeowner will be there. Not all of them, but on many of them. And then the guides will also, we have a little bit of the history of the buildings written down as well. So you can learn about the facade and the exterior and some of the architecture that we love to preserve and our mission is to preserve. So you can learn about the architecture as well as all the wonderful gardens.
Yeah, and of course, you lure people in to the garden tours to raise money. Some people in the fall open their homes to tours. Last year was not a good year for raising money for Quincy Preserves, but was probably a good year in a way for preservation because I bet a lot of people who were home, people in new homes thought, gee whiz, I don't know, I don't like that, I want to change that. I bet a lot of people in older homes said, you know what, I finally have the time. Let's get to start this restoration. You provide, I guess, would be expertise. It's not that you have a staff or anything like that, but if people have older homes, Quincy Preserves can help get them in touch with people who know how to preserve things and do it right so that you don't ruin the architectural significance. Because we all remember the pink aluminum siding on Park Place, which is now gone. But, you know, pink aluminum siding probably at the time was the best choice they thought they could make. And when you go to tear pink aluminum siding off, you have to do it carefully or you won't have anything left underneath the pink aluminum siding. So it's a process, isn't it? Talk a little bit. Who wants to talk about that process?
I can take that. It's definitely a process, and Quincy Preserves sees themselves as a conduit to help those either homeowners or even commercial owners provide a resource to help them improve their facade and building and do it in a way that's fitting for the appropriate style and time period of that home. And definitely that's all done through our fundraising and contributions from our members to allow us to have those opportunities to invest back into the community through our facade program, as well as a couple of different other opportunities that Quincy Preserves does to reinvest into the community.
Some people are afraid to get involved because they say, well, if my home is deemed historically significant, then I'll never be able to sell it or never be able to change it, or I won't be able to update my kitchen or, you know, whatever. But I mean, that's not true. You still own your home, and you can still do whatever you want to it, right?
Correct. And Quincy Preserves does not have any legality, any legal rights. It's more of an acknowledgement of the work and efforts done by, you know, the homeowner and so forth for preservation. So there is no, say, stringent requirements. Outside of the facade grants, there's some, you know, is rules and applications to get that money awarded. But beyond that, exactly. It's their property to do, especially on the interior.
Right.
You know?
So when we see the plaque, as we walk around town, we see plaques. That's a recognition from you that they are attempting and they are trying to keep the historic beauty of the home. But that doesn't mean there's not a microwave and a catering kitchen inside.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, again, one of the biggest struggles with older homes is marketing them to the modern-day population because we want it to be Wi-Fi. We want to have all this stuff. Everybody loves the look and feel and the wood, for example, of an older home, but nobody actually, you know, I still want, I want running water, for example. You know, I mean, an indoor bathroom would be nice. I'm all for historical preservation, but an indoor bathroom is pretty much a necessity.
And I would say that's a huge misconception. All of these homes, especially around this area, can evolve and change with the times. I live in an old home, and ours is completely a smart home. Like, you touch one light switch, everything turns off. So, I mean, that, those possibilities are out there. It's just a matter of how much investment someone wants to partake, as well as how much love and care someone wants to take for an older home set. Because I think some of those are the things I think people really get hung up on and realize that, oh, this is going to take a little bit more TLC to get it to a state that I'll enjoy it.
But many older homes were better built than some of the newer construction. And so, you know, you look at this edifice across the street from us that was once the Quincy Public Library and now it's the History Museum for the Historical Society. That thing's going to be standing a long time after some of these newer construction things downtown are on their second generation. And you look at the old Newcomb Hotel and now the poor blank lot there. If it hadn't been for that destructive fire and everything, that probably would have stood. That's part of the problem, isn't it? You can't save everything. Quincy Preserves, I know, has mounted some campaigns in the past to, I'd say, gently suggest that people modify their construction plans. I know that one of those corners was the corner of 20th and Main, where it was like, well, if we could, you know, convince the owner, which he can do whatever he wants, he owns the property, it's totally up to him. But I think there was some gentle persuasion, maybe sometimes not so gentle, maybe he thought, but it looks great now. It looks like it belongs. It doesn't look brand new. It looks old, even though it is brand new and very modern inside. So is that part of what Quincy Preserves tries to do, is kind of be proactive and say, before this gets too far down the road and it's so dilapidated, let's see what we can do to kind of bring this up? Because once things start to really be destroyed, it's very difficult and very costly to bring them back.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a part of our mission is really advocacy and making awareness of those structures that are, say, critical or becoming end of life, so that we could either restore them or preserve them to go forward. And I would say for Quincy Preserve, it's more of a role of communication and making awareness than it is of, you know, trying to be stringent or harsh on making criteria, but trying to be an advocate for preserving the great architecture we have in Quincy.
Well, you're both young folks, and let's talk. Yesterday I had Bruce Guthrie on from the district, and we were talking about, you know, trying to get more housing above the existing, you know, we've got 3- and 4-story buildings. Our building here is a perfect example. The old Lincoln Douglas Hotel, which at the time, the ballroom, and woohoo, this was the place to hang. And now it's been converted, transposed into an apartment living for older, lower-income seniors. And, of course, the ground floor is taken up by a very modern, although our equipment's not that modern, but a very modern radio station. But they try to keep the facade looking, you know, like the facade did. And, of course, the interior, some of it has been restored to its original pleasure and some of it's not. But how do you go about encouraging, like, downtown development, where the outside we still want to look very Washington Park-y, very, you know, 1880s to 1930s, but yet on the inside have all those modern amenities. How hard is that, Stephanie Kuchelski?
I think that most people, when you move to Quincy or you've lived in Quincy most of your life, that's part of the charm of the community, and that most people want to see that look of the facades. One of the things that we have is a facade program that is part grant, part loan for owners of these different commercial properties. So a lot of times we know that there's going to be a renovation or a project taking place downtown or in other areas of the community, we'll go out and try to talk to owners and say, listen, we have this program. If you just do these simple things, we can preserve the history of the building, also help you out with your project. And most people are pretty open and excited to learn about that.
And it's interesting, too, because another intersection that intrigues me is the intersection of 12th and Broadway. Okay, so at 12th and Broadway, we had at one time, you know, an old drugstore, a butcher shop, you know, Dieter's was in there, and that wasn't even the original thing. And then there was the Chinese food place, which, of course, was not a Chinese food place years ago. But when they started redeveloping that corner, I think Home Bank went first. And they built the building to kind of match the older buildings. And then First Bankers Trust kind of came in and said, well, we'll kind of have a facade that complements that as well. Well, now the original, one of the original buildings is gone completely. But, and so we could have had two very new, very gleaming, very 1990s, you know, architecture looking stuff there. What's the advantage? Because now that the original building's gone, there's nothing really there anchoring it. Zanger Real Estate is still there, but I mean, they've changed the facade. So from a preservation point of view, you have two existing banks that built buildings to look old, and yet the thing that they tried to match has now been demolished. What's the take on that from a preservation point of view?
I don't know. I have personal opinions on this. I'm a lover of architecture and history, but architecture in general, and so I see a value in both new and old. I just think that when we have older buildings in existence, we need to try as hard as we can as a community and as the public to preserve and keep those buildings in a natural, in their, you know, historic nature. But I also think that there are rooms for development and new growth and new buildings as well. And I like the combination, like the, is it St. Boniface Church? The St. Boniface Church is down here in the historic district. It doesn't look exactly like all of our historic facades, but it's an incredible building, and I love that being in the mix down here.
Yeah, there's a perfect example. It sticks out like a sore thumb, but not like a sore thumb, like a beautiful thumb. But, of course, that's, again, an architectural wonder. Now, that building is having some issues, too, with wear and tear. And I know that the Father Gus Tolton Center, they'd like that to be there. And, you know, a lot of things can happen. But now there's a perfect example. That gleaming 1950s, 1960s architecture was very out of place compared to the rest of Quincy. But now as Quincy ages and other older buildings unfortunately fall, it's not quite as, I mean, it still stands out, of course, but it's not quite as jarring as it was because the stuff around it started to modify. It's a constant process, isn't it?
Yeah, it's part of the architectural catalog of the community now. And so I think that's what Stephanie was getting at, is that we have to continually evolve. We can't just look at the 1890 buildings and say these are the most pristine ones that we need to just keep and emulate, but continue to evolve our catalog of buildings across the community so that we continue to add these great landmarks as we go forward.
Okay, well, you know, we'll see what the latest trend is. I mean, everybody's going to know if it has a metal roof, it was from a certain era. It's kind of like the Harvest Gold and Avocado Green kitchen. somewhere, that was a great idea one time. The Behind Garden Gates tour is tomorrow, June 12th from 9 to 1. You can get your tickets today for $15 at Emerald City Jewelers, at Curlin's, or online at quincypreserves.org. Or tomorrow you can go to 1550 Main, the Lorenzo Bull home, the Women's City Club, and buy your tickets there. And again, there are 10 stops on the tour. Most of them are in walking distance. One of them, 205 Woodlawn Court, you'll definitely have to drive to. Is that the one out by Baldwin School?
It's out by Baldwin, and Okay. Actually I work for the company doing some of the roadway work, so they're going to have an entrance open on 30th. And Maine, so that inside the barricades, so we can get to the home.
They worked hard on this garden. Don't shut them out. Wouldn't
yes.
it be terrible to have your house on the tour and you can't get to it? Okay. So, folks, you will be able to get to it, and it's $15 in advance, $18, and, of course, all the proceeds benefit Quincy Preserves and the work they do. Thank you so much for your time, Stephanie Kuchelski and Eric Luce, for what you do. It's a volunteer. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.